Before we get moving, if you're a member of the FCC, we have upcoming events to talk about. Project Kaisei. Does anybody know about this? This is the plastic vortex that is in the middle of the ocean. We have on Tuesday, November 10th, a very important event. Doug Woodring and Karin Malmstrom, who was out on Project Kaisei. If you look at the latest issue of The Correspondent, you'll see a very large article about this. They went in the middle of the ocean to find this huge pile of garbage in the middle of the ocean, and they're talking about what's happening to our seas. As a sailor, and I know there are other sailors here, it's very important to us, and this is something actually for the last couple of years that we've been focusing on, is the quality of the aquatic life on the planet. So this is another in an ongoing series of issues that you'll see about this. And if you have an opportunity on the 10th of November, please do join us for that lunch about Project Kaisei and the plastic vortex. Capturing the plastic vortex is what they're called. Anyway, so that's not what you're here for tonight. Obviously, you're not going to see a whole lot of plastic this evening. It gives me great pleasure to turn over the podium to Robin Moyer, who is, in fact, one of the photographers we try to keep down, but the irrepressible Robin Moyer will now introduce Dominic Knarr, which is the reason you're here tonight. So thank you all for joining us, and please welcome Robin Moyer.
Any photographers in the house? One, two. All right, Ted, put your hand down. Photographers are not great with numbers. I'm just trying to figure it out. 1983 to 2009 is 25 or 26? 26. This is a numbers game. Robert Capa. Anybody know Robert Capa? Or of Robert Capa? Few? He's the guy that made all the pictures from the Spanish Civil War when he was 23 years old. He's the guy that photographed the landing on Normandy Beach on D-Day when he was 29 years old. Dominic, Hong Kong boy that he is, falls in between. And I don't know, most photographers would give a lifetime to have taken so many incredible photographs in such a short period of time. It's really unbelievable. This young man, spawn of Wally and Anita. Hey. Has in, 4 years? His first kind of acquaintance with real photography was at the Eddie Adams workshop. Some of us remember Dear Eddie, who made the famous photograph of the police chief in Saigon executing a Viet Cong suspect and changed the whole course of the war in Vietnam. But apparently Dominic went to the Eddie Adams workshop, was inspired, did well, and 2 years later became a professional photographer at age 27. I don't know, I bought my first professional camera when I was 26. It's all about being there, being square, Dominic Knarr. Please, let's see what he has to say.
Just give me 1 second, I gotta figure out how we're gonna connect my computer to all this. Yeah, I know. Wait, everybody can still see where they're eating? I'm sure it's really good. I actually wanted to quote Kappa, but I just got to quote Bob Davis. Oh, that's green, right. You got to hang out, tell the world.
Apologies on behalf of the FCC. Those of you in that corner are going to have to look over here. I know, it's all completely screwed up. Trying to make that screen work, but they've been having problems all night.
Do you have sound at least over there? Okay, people can move. People can shift around. It's kind of like a living room. Just make yourself comfortable wherever you think you can feel comfortable. Also, I'm 6'3". That might be the reason why I'm standing in front of the screen. I'm sorry about that as well. I can't move the... he taped it down. Okay, and I used to go to rock concerts, and I was really embarrassed that I was really tall, so I used to hang out like this at the rock concert. I hope this helps a bit. So I was going to quote Kappa, because I couldn't think of anybody else. I have a bad memory in terms of remembering quotes. But obviously somebody else did that already, so I can't do that. So I'm going to quote Bob Davis, and he said right when he went to the loo and I came out, he said, "Home is where my cameras are," and I thought that was perfect. Home is where my cameras are. I've been looking for a home for a long time, and long time, it might not be that long actually at all, for a year, bouncing around in different cities and just trying to find where I'm supposed to be. Finally found a place, and I live in Nairobi, Kenya now. Not that I actually spend a lot of time there, but at least I can say that's my home for now. And I'm going to be showing you just a brief beginning of how I kind of got started. I think the interesting aspects are that I'm 26 and I was kind of focused to do what I wanted to do. And I had a huge amount of luck that things just worked out for me. And I'm going to explain how that happened. And again, I'm really lucky to be speaking here, and I thank the FCC for letting me have this evening with you guys. Hope you enjoy it as much as I do. I used to work for the South China Morning Post as a staff photographer. I started as an intern, thanks to Hugh Van Ness, who used to be is a member here and recently passed away. He was kind of, if you'd like, my first mentor by being the guy who kicked me in the ass without even knowing it. He saw some of my pictures because he's close family friends with my family, and he just pretty much forced me to take an internship at the South China Morning Post. Lucky enough, it worked out, and I went back for another year, and I became a staff photographer until I couldn't take it anymore and quit. But that's another story. I ended up leaving the South China Morning Post to cover conflict situations, and I was first brought into sort of chaos by covering the WTO. I don't know how many of you remember the WTO in Hong Kong. I remember walking down like Wan Chai Road or Hennessy Road. No, wait, one of the... I've been gone for 2 years, I don't remember the roads anymore. Either way, everything was closed. There were buses driving on the road, but these Korean sort of demonstrators had blocked out different roads. It felt totally chaos. I've never seen Hong Kong being blocked off like that by sort of citizens. I mean, not citizens, I mean sort of random people that flew in. So that was really exciting, and I think I really got into that. So I quit the paper as soon as I could, and then I heard that there was fighting in East Timor, which is a sort of used to be Indonesian kind of colony kind of thing, and they had their independence, and there was a very violent independence. And 2006, the violence was still going on, and this time, as sad as it always is that the violence was between the people who supported the Indonesians and the people who didn't. So I went down there with a sort of slight promise from AFP to buy my pictures, and headed there. So this is kind of what I saw. I think I instantly shot differently than I did for the newspaper. I think it's really important to photograph for yourself, and because I bought the ticket and I risked to go down there, I shot for myself completely. You know, if you're told to do something, I don't think you do it as well as if you, you know, do it by your own accord. And I think that's what happened here. Sorry, I'm just going. It was pretty. I had a great time because to cover a conflict, by not being stressed in terms of kidnappings or, I don't know, violent assaults or all that stuff, is really good to have a first start like that, because East Timor was really chill. I had a motorcycle. I had my press pass out. I had my cameras out. I drove around every morning before the violence usually happened. I went for a swim in my swimming trunks, and you'd have to go past all the soldier blood chalk checkpoints and everything, and I could do it no problem. That's not the case anymore where I've worked, so I'm really lucky that that was my first time. I really got in touch with the people. I was tearing when I left, actually. I stayed there for a month, and it was really hard to leave. And it was the first time I got let into people's lives like this. I'm going to stop in this picture because this is a family of Rodriguez Gonzalez, and he was shot by military. It was pretty much the police who were fighting the military. The police was favored by the West, I believe, and the military was favored by the East. And so they were obviously keen to fight because they had the weapons to do so. And I met this family in the morgue, and my first time in an experience with a morgue and witnessing corpses and things like that. And they let me in. They didn't let anybody else in, but they let me in. So I spent the entire afternoon photographing them and them taking off the clothes that were on their husband and father and son and putting new clothes on to prepare them for burial. I then followed them for the next day for the funeral, and this is at the funeral. It was a photographer's nightmare because the light was coming from the back. You know, I mean, you're shooting towards the light, and that was the only place to stand. But luckily, I managed to get something out of it. And that's his son, the mother, and the brother hugging each other. And I thought I connected. I was really emotional at the time. On the month anniversary of the shooting of Rodriguez, they had a sort of an anniversary, and all the families came to the place where they all got executed, and you know, had flowers and candles. And for Rodriguez, I was the first person they gave the flower to in front of the entire international press corps. And suddenly I realized that by being there, you're also giving them hope, I think, and giving them the time of day, and that you care, and that maybe somebody else will care. So I put my cameras down and put the first flower down. Thanks very much. So this family will always stick with me. And ironically, I got an email about 2 years ago. It was somebody who knew the family and hadn't seen him in like 7 years, and was shocked to see their life and the death of his neighbor through my photographs, and wanted to reach him, as you know, badly. But I didn't have any numbers. I just met him in these situations. But that's funny that some random guy knew that guy and saw him in my pictures. And also, I try and stay as long as I can. Everybody left, all the crowds left. I'll stay at the end until the last family member leaves. So that was East Timor. I then went back to university. I actually left university to pursue kind of figuring out what photography means to me. I think that's a really good thing for anybody who's doing something else and they want to do something that they're really passionate about, to give it a shot and try it. So when I got back to university, I was ready to go. I changed my major, and then I was, you know, I knew what I wanted. I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do it, or how anybody was going to pay me. Incidentally, AFP, as AFP's local rates were very low. But luckily, I had the support of the communities there. I lived with the family. They barely charged me anything at all. So I could survive by taking the pictures and getting paid and not actually having too much of a sort of minus, which is usually the case with most of the photographers that work, by the way. All the things that you see by many of the photographers that is really great work is because it's personal work, and they put their money in and usually don't get it back. Anyway, I went back to university, and I was itching to get out there again and see some more fighting, I guess. It sounds stupid, and I think your initial act of going there is always selfish. It'd be lying if I said it wouldn't be. But as soon as you're there, you realize that your selfishness kind of goes away, and you're right there because you see the issues that are at hand. And Gaza, for me, is will never leave me. And I got taken in by a family. So I can't wait to go back. I email them all the time. The situation here that was really interesting for me was the fact that Fatah and Hamas were fighting each other in the Gaza Strip. What happened was the Israeli settlers got pulled out of Gaza, which sounds like a good thing, but it's actually a really bad thing, because when the Israeli settlers were there, they couldn't completely close down Gaza. They had to keep it kind of open. So you had Gazans traveling over into Israel or into West Bank. They were able to kind of get through the fences. What happened when the Israeli settlers got pulled out, Israel was able to clamp down completely on Gaza and close it down like a prison. So it's the largest open-air prison in the world. Nothing goes in, nothing goes out without the clearance of Israel. And for the people, that meant a lot more problems. Yes, okay, it didn't take them 6 hours to do a normally 15-minute trip because of all the checkpoints, but it meant that they had no more way to even escape for a little bit, even to find any kind of sort of food that was coming in that wasn't cleared by Israel. And I don't know, if you boil a pot of water and you fill it to the top and you put up the heat all the way and you close the lid, what's going to happen? It's going to explode. So that's what I think happened in Gaza, that they pulled the heat up so high on the population and on the different factions like Fatah and Hamas that they exploded and they started fighting each other. The sad part is that Hamas and Fatah are kind of family members in a way, because like any family, you'll have a brother who's sort of conservative, you know, he likes reading, he likes religion, and then you have the other brother who likes to have a cigarette, likes to shave his beard, likes to sort of go out at night, not drink, they don't drink, right? Just be a bit more liberal. And so what happened, and which is why I called my photo essay When Brothers Fight, is that they're usually brothers who are fighting each other. And I witnessed many brothers kissing their brother goodbye at the grave. Gaza, in terms of fighting, was a lot different because it was street fighting, while East Timor was sort of open areas and mass people, while this was kind of really tight street fighting. You couldn't really get close too much, even though I think once I remember trying to hide underneath a brick that was about this high. Obviously, that wasn't a good idea. Sorry, Mom. don't worry, I got out of there really quickly, so I say. I'm just going to move on. Sorry, one second. Here is a dam that Israel built, and they flood it when they want to. So here's a family trying to get to a funeral, but they can't really get to it properly because Israel decided to open the dam. I'm going to just move this glass. There's a lot of equipment and water. These are sort of the bad boys of Gaza. They don't exist anymore because they were like the Fatah members, and they were the most wanted Fatah members of by Hamas. They like to take people from the streets and from their cars if they have too long of a beard or look too much like a radicalist or Hamas, and torture them, and then put them up on the roof naked. And usually when it rains and you have burns and you have cuts, you'll probably be in much more pain. That's not the bad part. Most people can deal with that. I don't think we could, and I don't think I could. But most of those guys deal with it. What the hardest thing is for a Hamas guy who gets nabbed by these guys is that they shave the eyebrows, the beard, and the head. And that's a complete humiliation. They can deal with the torture, such as this, but they can't deal with sort of having the defacing of their sort of religious aspects, such as a beard. Probably Gaza was also the first time that I really got into sort of closer contact fighting, and everything's very fast there, and people run. When they deliver a martyr to the cemetery, they're running for about 2 to 3 kilometers, all the way from where the family, the last time the family says goodbye, the women say goodbye, to where they're going to bury him. They're all running, and you're going to run with them. And they have about 15 guys around the body, so they can switch, so not one guy's running the entire time. It's quite amazing that they want to bring them as fast as they can to Allah. At a Fatah rally, each group always wanted to show the other group that they were more powerful and more popular. Ironically, at this one, the rain started to pour like There Was No Tomorrow. And Hamas was really happy and said that God spoke, you know. This is in a house where there was heavy fighting. And this is the last stairway. And I remember all the locals trying to show me the blood on the stairs. But you couldn't really, you couldn't tell what it was. But I thought the handprint was pretty clear. Last desperate attempt to flee. I call this picture, I don't name pictures, but I really thought this was poignant. It's a daily gathering, because this is kind of a daily event during the fighting. It was every day you'd go to this cemetery. I was the only photographer there. All the journalists, all the foreign journalists were kidnapped at this point, and all the local journalists stayed away from here. But I must say, I would have never done it without my fixer, who's the guy who gets you in and out of places. I love him to bits, and he would be right behind me, holding my shoulder, holding my t-shirt, holding my hand, whatever it took for me to know that he was right behind me, always ready to go. And he would do a twitch, and I knew it was done, we need to move on. At night, we would walk through sort of rallies and things, and he would not let go of my hand. It was amazing. And actually, this is my fixer. This is Amjad. The entire time he said he wanted to bring me somewhere where he can find peace. And he said that luckily, because Gaza's on the Mediterranean, I hope. I'm sorry, when I talk about it, I forget a few things. But he said, luckily, because there's water, I can breathe. And I didn't quite get what he meant. And at the end of my stay, I was almost feeling like I was going to lose it. And I've only been there a month. Well, they've been there their entire life. Amjad got out once for an evening because the gate, the walls fell at one section, so everybody ran out. And he held the entire night in Egypt under a stadium and then ran back. And that was his night out. And Amjad wanted to bring me to this place. I didn't quite know where it was. And we get to the beach, and it's 8 degrees. It's really cold. But he wanted to kind of make me feel the same thing. And we set up a fire in the back, and he said, make sure you wear the right scarf, because the Israelis are watching us right now. We're the only two people on the Gaza beach. I'm sure there's a destroyer over there, the wall's over there, and there's a drone up here, and you could hear the drone. And he kind of pulled me in the water, and we were like little kids and jumping around and doing handstands and everything like that. And then I decided to get my camera into the water, as I usually do, without water housing. Yeah. Anyway, and he had this moment where he just swam back and forth, and that was his peace. That was his little space where he was outside of Gaza. I then still was in university, obviously, even though the radio, the school radio and the school newspaper kept on calling me. It was, where are you right now? I'm like, I'm in Gaza. Are you going to come back to class? I'm like, hopefully, yeah, I'm trying to at one point. I had a problem with staying in class because I usually fall asleep in class. So I figured it's just, might as well just stay out of class. At least you're being productive. But my main thesis on my last year was Detroit. The biggest mistake I probably made in terms of university kind of decisions was that I should have worked on the healthcare in Toronto, healthcare of North America, because the amount of crazy people there are in Toronto is, knock your brains out. I mean, my mom knows that we walked down the street and every 5 minutes there's somebody screaming or like smashing their head against the wall or something like that. It's ridiculous how many crazy people there are in Toronto, and people just keep walking past them. I don't know, maybe I grew up in Hong Kong and we don't see that many crazy people, and they might just see them all the time, but I thought this was an issue that nobody even cared about. But I didn't photograph it. I wanted to do the United States of America. I grew up here, and I was always fascinated with the U.S., so I worked on Detroit, not on the healthcare of Toronto, which I should have probably done. And I call this piece In This Forgotten City, because Detroit is kind of forgotten. Downtown is flourishing in a way, but it's just, you can walk it in about 15 minutes. It's really safe. Cops are all over the place. Oh, it's great. Beautiful buildings and everything. And then you go just a little bit outside of Detroit downtown, tiny Detroit downtown, and you hit sort of the inner circle of Detroit, which is majority 80% African-Americans. You have 40,000 families with no water, no access to water, and most of them have kids, so they never want to report it, because if they do, they lose their kids. You have extreme gang violence. It's the highest murder rate. It has been the highest murder rate for the longest time. Education, schools. I went to so many schools that were completely destroyed. The government doesn't seem to care. Most gasoline stations in Detroit inner city, not downtown and not the suburbs. Suburbs are great. They're beautiful. All these nice SUVs and, you know, people with a lot of money. But inner city Detroit, you'll see gasoline stations mostly like this. I don't think I saw many working. The citizens have to sort of defend them by themselves. This guy puts a couple of weapons around his building. This one's in the back, just in case somebody tries to assault him from the back. And they have clashes every night. I must say also, he's part of the Blood Gang. It's a reference to L.A., but I don't think they're actually a Bloods gang in Detroit. That's why they're wearing red for the Bloods. And he's a drug dealer, as most people are. Every block has two ends. Each end there's a drug dealer, or crack house or trap house, as they call it. When old ladies want to get food, they have to go to a department store that is not really a department store. It's the store that's at the gasoline station, which is closed down, and it only sells alcohol and your bare essential of vegetables or bare essentials of anything. So you wonder why people take drugs and drink their way through their life. Most of the buildings in Detroit are destroyed, have fallen apart, or just been taken apart for parts. This boy got killed by a cop. He was black, he was unarmed, and got shot by a white cop who has 7 or 8 outstanding sort of, not warrants, well, he's in suspicion of shooting 7 black kids within like 2 years, unarmed. He's never been put on suspension or even called in. There, the Detroit's own mayor, Kilpatrick, I hope it's Kilpatrick. He had like 9 warrants of arrests, and he even had one of those beeper thingies. That was the mayor of Detroit, so he couldn't leave Detroit at all. So welcome to the government of Detroit. Debris all over the place. It's not from storms. It's just from lack of caring. And most of these kids just grow up in sort of really isolated places. This kid was cool. It was my first day. I'm just putting this picture in because I was really scared. I was in Detroit, the only white kid around. And he comes up to me. He's like, "You're either a crackhead or an undercover cop. Either way, there are 3 niggas watching you right now." And I'm like, "Ooh, really not how I want to start my first day." But then he joked around and said, "Don't worry, this is my neighborhood." It's like the only house that he had on the block was his house. Every other house had been abandoned. So I was safe, supposedly. Didn't stay very long. It was a little creepy. Again, gun crime is probably one of the reasons. He's convicted for murder and served his time and is not allowed to have a gun. But he's scared that somebody will come by and attack him. So he still carries a couple guns. I got in trouble for this picture, actually. The Canadian government took my car apart because they thought I was running guns into Canada from Detroit because I spent too long of a time in Detroit caring about issues and things like that or having a good time. And so they took the entire car apart. And I usually give pictures to my subjects sometimes, especially sort of gang guys. It helps them, it helps them to understand how I'm taking their picture and they're really excited about being in a picture. I forgot that I had slipped one into the back of the car, into the seat. And when they took the seat apart, they found that picture. And automatically, they pull out their weapons, tell me to get the hood on the car. And I'm like, "Ah, shit." And I wanted to go home. I was on my way home. And I look over and I see a family look at me and going, I was like, I didn't do anything. They really thought I was a gun smuggler of some sorts. I had no planning whatsoever, so... And they call Detroit sidewalk, schooling in Detroit, they call sidewalk high, because kids learn how to grow up and learn their education on sidewalks, not so much in school. All right. Everybody still with me? Nobody nod off anywhere? All right, cool.
We are here.
All right, thanks, Bob. Okay. One of the things I started doing was working for the Wall Street Journal. Really happy with that. Even got lucky that I'm not going to say it too loud in case it might not come true, but I do cover mostly stories for the Wall Street Journal, as in I'm their photographer in Africa now, which is great. Their young photo team, they had, if you guys know the Wall Street Journal, it used to be stencils, right? Now they open up a photo desk and they're embracing photography, which is unheard of in our time when people are talking about the death of photojournalism and death of print photojournalism. These guys have opened up shop, so you better watch out. I lived in Egypt for, I think, 2 months, and I just kind of loved the place and hated the place at the same time. It's really hard to live in a country, I notice now. I grew up in Hong Kong and Toronto, where you don't know the language, especially Arabic is extremely hard. So I think that was one of the reasons why I left. It's just your little daily details that you're trying to do just gets extremely hard. And I got asked by the Canadian Photographer Association to write about how do you prepare to live abroad and work abroad. And one of the key things I now know is live in a country, or at least have your home base in a country that where you speak the language of. And my dad even mentioned that to me when I was trying to find a place in Asia that wasn't Hong Kong. He said the Philippines, because people speak English. And if you want to get anything done quickly, you can probably get it done. I feel like that in Kenya. It's snickering over there. I feel like that. I know. I feel like that in Kenya as well. I can get my visas sorted quickly. I can get all things done that would have taken me forever if I was living in a country that I couldn't speak the language of. Either way, so I did a story for the Wall Street Journal on the Muslim Brotherhood, or rather the retreat of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I mixed a few personal pictures with the Simon pictures. But I guess I just want to show you guys how Egypt's impression on me was. And I hope you can read it from the pictures. I'm going to stop talking now. I'm speed talking. I'll give it a rest. In the Muslim Brotherhood office, interesting guys. I used to read about them, and then I got to meet them. Obviously not the supreme leaders, they're kind of untouchables. But the guy in the front, where you can see his butt, he's going to, hopefully, he thinks, going to be the new supreme leader. Supreme leaders are all 80. I met this guy, and I was like, oh, you're the supreme leader. He's like, no, I'm only 60. I'm like, all right. In the back, the frame picture says Allah. He's been imprisoned and tortured numerous times by the Egyptian government. Cairo, right close to my house or apartment. I lived with two girls and 16 cats in a small apartment. Super interesting. Not the way I thought my sort of North Africa, Middle East experience would be on the first go. This was in my favorite place called Kit Kat. I wanted to live there, but everybody said I was mad, because when you look for apartments in Egypt, in Cairo, you actually have to ask, you know, can mixed people come? Can I bring friends that are girls and boys? And most places say no. So you have to live in specific areas where it's okay for girls to come by if you're a guy, and the other way around, and then to stay on. I couldn't live in Kit Kat. In Alexandria. Alexandria is beautiful. My dad used to live in Alexandria, and I would have wanted to live in Alexandria, not Cairo, but it's a bit too far from everything. But you're right at the water. It just feels totally more chill. It's beautiful there. One of the biggest businessmen in Alexandria, and he funds the local government sort of healthcare. The Muslim Brotherhood will put up a little healthcare system that's tiny, and then he'll just wad in money and build a new one, said the government did it, just so the people will think the Muslim Brotherhood aren't strong enough. Cairo again. I really fell in love with shapes and light there and people. I mean, it's just, it's a really ancient feeling. Happy. by the way, which is the password for the internet here, just in case anybody needs it. Now they have to change it. Shooting police or anything, I mean, I got so many times the sign for arrested, once by army and police at the same time. They don't like you shooting anything, like a bridge in a touristy area. Yeah, you're not going to shoot the bridge. So you've got to be really sneaky. And most of these pictures I shot from the hip, not from looking through the eyepiece, including this one. Another Muslim Brotherhood member. He's confused that I stayed so long. He's like, you got one picture, can you go now? I'm like, no, I'm going to chill out. Then I fell asleep because it was really boring. And I woke up again and took that picture and then left. I tend to fall asleep a lot. It's just this thing I do. We're like crossing front lines and I'm asleep. Somebody will wake me up. We're like, we're good. And I'm like, oh, nice. You know.
So before when you melt down, you actually
sleep? Yeah. Just for 2 seconds. It's a little nap there. I'll just finish the Africa stuff with this before I kind of finish the evening. How are we with time? All right. Fragile border is kind of really amazing because I live in Kenya now, but if you go just east, you get right to the border of Somalia, and if you're in Nairobi, you really feel like you're sort of in Africa. If you go to sort of the border of Somalia, you really feel like you're sort of in the Middle East almost. Everything's Arabic, sort of full burqas. The feeling is totally different. Like, you're in a different country, and it's Kenya. So I went to the large... I heard, I don't know if you guys know, but the largest refugee camp in the world is in Kenya. It's almost 500,000 people. And it's mostly Somalis, but a few Ethiopians and Sudanese. I didn't know that, and I lived in Kenya. I was really embarrassed. So obviously what I do when I don't know something, I usually buy a ticket and try and figure out what's really going on there. So I bought a ticket to go to this camp called the Dab refugee camp, and it's split up into three different camps. And I spend my time in the Dagahali camp, which is where Médecins Sans Frontières work out of. And they're the only foreigners who actually live in the camp. All the other NGOs, I'm not a big fan of NGOs, by the way. Not a big fan, I'm just saying some NGOs. MSF are amazing, they're great. They really do a really good job. But all the other NGOs in the UN live in Dadaab, which is about a 40-minute drive away from the camps. And they drive in convoy, and they only work from 10 to 4 or something like that. While MSF is in the camp in tents, surrounded by all the people, and they open their gates at 6 and they close them at 6. They work 12 hours a day. And I stay with them, which is great. I could just walk out of the compound and be straight in the camp. I then also got an assignment for the New York Times because I was in the area. So some of the pictures are for the New York Times, some of the pictures are for myself, and then I ended up getting a magazine to give me an assignment as well. My bread and butter, The National from Abu Dhabi. They're really my bread and butter in East Africa. And the magazine is called M Magazine. And the editor is a close friend of mine, and he really supported me by giving me the assignment. I don't think they even ran it yet, but he just wanted me to have the money so I can keep doing what I do. And there's a lot of people out there like that. I really appreciate it. Somalis are really tricky to photograph. They don't actually want to be photographed. So you've got to be really sneaky. Not an unusual sight. In Kenya, Mogadishu Hotel. So the Dagahali camp, the Dab is amazing. It's all flat, and this wind goes through. Everybody who goes there talks about the wind. It's really hard to photograph wind with photography. And I like this picture just because all the plastic bags fly through the air, like vertically, horizontally, and all the trees catch them. So it's kind of my picture of the wind. This is right on the border with Somalia. They're kind of Somalis, but they call themselves Kenyans, but they completely look Somalis. You've got the high cheekbones, the thin noses. And you got the Somali...
what's it called?
Anybody know? Somali skirt, dress, sarong in Somali. No? Okay. Boy running from a sandstorm. Ironically, I was in Dagahali camp for 5 days trying to photograph sandstorms. It never happened. I went in for 45 minutes with the New York Times, and the sandstorm came. So New York Times got the sandstorm picture. The other magazine didn't. Again, another thing, all the guys who photograph and stay with the UN, they don't get the nice light. because they come in at 10 and they leave at 4, so they have the worst light in the world. I mean, they at 11, it was just boiling hot, and it was painful to even work. And the light was like straight down for 3 hours. I don't even know how that works. So you got to go really, really early to get the picture. And luckily, because I lived in the camp, I could go. There's a girl who got shot in Mogadishu just about 2 days before I took the picture. And she was in school. And Al-Shabaab started firing at some other clan. And she got hit with like six others. And she went to the local hospital that was close to the school. And fighting broke out inside the hospital as well. So she's 12 and can't seem to go anywhere that she can get treated. So a couple guys put her in a car and put all the other wounded in a car and drove towards Kenya. It seems the only option. And 500,000 people have done that in the last 18 years. This boy lost his parents, his arms and his eyes to Ethiopian bombing. I was surprised. One thing that people don't tell you with the Somali... So this is really depressing. I'm going to throw in some happy pictures at one point, party pictures or something. I feel really bad talking about this the entire time. But I'd like to just put this out, that nobody told me this. Nobody said that Somalis were bullied and killed by the Ethiopians. Ethiopians were there as sort of a security group, security army. But what happened was the Ethiopians don't like the Somalis. The Somalis don't like the Ethiopians at all. And if there were small arms fire coming from an area, the Ethiopians would just bomb the entire area. And every person I spoke to that I met had some sort of link to the Ethiopian sort of war machine. And that was just something that I didn't know. And I was surprised that nobody had told me this before. And one of my friends, Ed O, he's like 21 years old. He was eight. Talk about like young and being crazy. He's eight. He was 19 when he went to Mogadishu. This little Chinese dude. And he worked there for a month in one of the most dangerous times. And it was he was in a checkpoint, an Ethiopian checkpoint, and he was the next car up. And a woman had walked up and tried to cross the checkpoint. And the Ethiopian wanted to kind of grope her and check her for equipment or whatever it was. And she didn't have it because she didn't want to have a Christian touching her. So he pulled out his gun and shot her in the head. And Edo is sitting in the car and he can't photograph it because obviously he'll put his life into harm's way. But that's how aggressive it is, and it should be talked about a bit more, and it should be investigated a bit more. The suitcase of a Somali general, he was in charge of rooting down Al-Qaeda in Mogadishu, in Somalia, but they kept on attacking his house and him, so he left. And the only thing he took was his suitcase, and it has all his military documents inside. Scarily enough, I was in the room with him that is totally blocked out and nobody's allowed to see him except me. My translator wasn't allowed to come in. And while he sat there, he got a text. And he gets texts all the time from the Al-Shabaab. And then the text said, "You're talking to a white journalist right now. We can see you." And I was like, okay. My heart like sank down to the stomach. I was like, keep cool. Do another 10 minutes and get out of there. So, Ethiopian attack again. Mostly the children, and mostly they lose their parents. Boy who's suffering from high degree of cancer, they keep sending him to the hospital to try and get him sent to Nairobi, but nobody does anything, so he just suffers in this little health clinic, set up by MSF, and they can't do anything. This girl, we saw her in a wheelbarrow, and MSF stopped and put her in the car, and I felt really bad taking a photograph of her, because they're all screaming at me, so I decided to, like, plop her under my... So I was carrying her and taking pictures. And it seemed okay. People were happy that I was helping and taking pictures. Somalis are quite crazy about picture taking. Girl who got attacked by Ethiopians. Lost her entire family. And her brother's with her, but he can't speak, talk, or really act as a normal human being anymore. Sort of Somali-Kenyan elders talking about the situation. Trying to figure out how to bridge the gap between Kenyans and Somalis. In Garissa. Garissa is sort of the main city close to Somalia in Kenya. Again, I mean, it doesn't look Kenyan at all. I like this picture. Again, big trading. Somalis are tradesmen. If you're ever in the desert, hang around a Somali. He probably has phone network because he needs to do business. Kenyans picked up a lot of Somali cigarettes, so they burn them. I think we were trying to steal a couple, and they didn't like that either. They're the worst cigarettes in the world. More early morning market in Garissa. In the camp. Prayer. I've had access into mosques, but this one they said no. You're not Muslim, so you have to stay outside. So I tried to photograph outside. At least they don't have brick walls. Would have been harder to photograph into the building. And this is the last picture of the Dadaab. And if anybody's in Toronto in the next couple of weeks, there's a show in my gallery. I'm represented by a gallery called Oldbourne Gallery, and they're just. I have my first solo show with them, and they're showing the Fragile Border piece. We're okay. One more piece, and then. Do you want to see one bonus thing before I find the end thing, or do you want to just see the end thing? Okay. All right. You guys are really quiet.
That was Dominic's
yeah. That was over there.
Bonus it is.
Okay, give me a second. Please. Just one more, I guess. I mean, before the ending. I got a cool ending sort of for you guys. Kimia 2 is the Congolese offensive against the FDLR. I'm going to be talking about Congo afterwards because it's the piece that's showing downstairs, and it's also the piece I fell in love with. I went to Congo and I fell in love with East Africa because of Congo. And I'll be talking about it a lot. This is in August, right before I went to France in Perpignan. So this is the last really big assignment I had. And Kimia 2 is the offensive against the FDLR. The war between the government and the CNDP, which are sort of pro-Tutsi guys, ended in December 2008. The war between the government and the FDLR restarted in January 2009. So if you're talking about conflict for the civilians and what they deal with it the entire time. It never stops. It's just different groups fighting each other. So for the civilian population, it's just extremely hard. They deal with numerous deaths, even more rapes, and all kinds of bad stuff. So Kimia 2 was kind of a lighter story in terms of what we were covering. We were looking at what happened after the government had pushed out the FDLR, which are Hutu-based. They're Rwandans, but are Hutus. I'm not going to get into the Tutsi thing. It's really complicated. But all you need to know is that it's still happening. It's not over. It just moved from Rwanda to DR Congo. And nobody seems to care because 5 million people have died in the last 10 years. It's the highest number since World War II. And you hear the numbers, and I hear the numbers. I'm like, yeah. My part is I go there. But it's just numbers that you can't understand. And most people can't give it the attention they should. DR Congo, I lost my point. Anyway, I'll show the picture. Oh, yes, phones, right? So we all have mobile phones, and the things that are in the mobile phones, and I'm sure some of you have heard this already, is cassiterite. It's tin, and it comes from Congo. And the FDLR was using that to fund their kind of war, because they held control of most of the cassiterite mines in Congo. The government got its act together, and it met the general of the military in the eastern province. This guy went to school, a university in China, in France, in Congo. Amazing guy. I mean, he was doing PowerPoint presentations on their attack strategies with finger-touching computers. It was amazing. So no wonder they're really fighting the FDLR really well this time. They got a good guy, and he's like this short. It's cute. But super smart and knows what he's doing. Anyway, so they retook the mines. And now it's in government control. And what this means is at least that all the miners get sort of registered. Everything is, hopefully everything gets registered and things don't slip into sort of weapons. I did this again for the Wall Street Journal. And this is sort of the partnership that I'm growing now with them. And I work with Sarah Childress, who's a journalist there, and she's super nice and we work really well together. This is in South Kivu in the eastern province of DR Congo, and it's really in the middle of nowhere. The closest airport is in Rwanda, and then you drive over, and then you drive for about 5 hours, and then you walk about 2 hours, and then you get here, which are sort of the mining areas. And the Air Congo is so rich in minerals that you'll walk around and you see minerals lying everywhere. And I picked one up, and one of the soldiers like snapped it out. He's like, you can't steal that. And I'm like, it's lying right there. But I got one, just a small one. Gave it to my buddy Jonathan, who's an SCMP photographer. He collects rocks. So I thought it was a cool rock. They kind of dig these mines out with nothing larger than this microphone. Pieces of equipment, no heavy equipment, and they go about 180 meters down into the earth. While I was photographing, rocks came down and pretty much hit my flash off, and you all kind of just lean against the wall and hope there's not more coming. And I'm not trying to say that I am tough and everything, because these guys sleep down there for 3 days. They go down, sleep there, eat there, everything, because they don't want to lose their spot. And you can barely breathe. I mean, there's no air. There's no air at all. And it's all this dust that's flying around. And it's obviously not very safe. In this mine, three guys died recently. And usually they have the wives or the girlfriends of the miners working the water, and they'll clean out the sort of the dirt and try and get the cassiterite out. Then you got women that carry it for 2 hours across the mountain. And we were heaving and puffing at that point. She was outpacing us by far. And then it goes into a truck. I like this because I didn't know this, but each bag is by a miner, so they have to put their name down, because if it's a bad miner, there won't be any cassiterite in it, and you don't use them again. And then it goes to Bukavu, the South Kivu city, and this is where all the bad stuff happens, because there's all these guys that the miners are just trying to make a living, but here's where it gets really shady. This guy is cool, man. He's like, his job is to take the iron out of the dirt and remove the iron from the cassiterite. So he has this little magnet and just wipes the dirt with the magnet. That's his job the entire day. He's just taking a break. And then they usually clean it out. And voila, ready for the United States of America. The shipment is going to the U.S. Soldiers hanging out on top of the mines. They just retook the place. And there's fighting about 4 hours marching from here. Still against the FDLR. Inside the mines. It was great. I mean, it was beautiful to photograph in there. It's really scary. And hard, tricky with lighting. There's no light whatsoever. And miners' boots and socks. And after a long day's work, they all go home. I like this picture. Anyway. I'm going to finish off with the piece that you've seen downstairs. I'm just going to check if the sound's working. I just need Michael, sound, please. Oh. Okay, I was talking to my buddy, and I was like, we're so savvy with computers, and we can't figure out how to play the music and the pictures at the same time. I watched a presentation with John Stammeyer, who has had pictures here and everything, and he was doing the same thing. He was like balancing three things at once. If it's too loud, you gotta say something.
Journaliste. De quoi parle-t-il?
Nini? Otike ni nani? Ya ministro atike ngo. Afrika.
Thanks very much. I forgot one thing. My buddy Tim, he's a videographer, and most of the sounds are mine, just the gunfire was his because I couldn't do two things at once. I was photographing. Well, video camera, you got audio and video at the same time. Just want to say thanks to him. I'm going to move over there now.
Standard FCC rules apply. If you have a question, we've got some microphones floating around. Stick your hand up, identify yourself, ask your question. I'm going to start. Robin, I think, has a few questions that he wanted to talk with Dominic about. So please, Robin.
Wow. Hello? Okay.
Hello? Well, I was going to ask some facetious questions about the future of photojournalism, but obviously the future is here.
And out there.
Well, yeah, baby. We're looking at magazines closing right, left, and center, and, big important magazines like Gourmet closed down the other day, but some photographers seem to have managed to figure out the way the world is working in 2009. I don't know what the question is, man. You've just answered it for me.
Well, I'm really, again, the thing with the Wall Street Journal, for them to open up a photo department is really uplifting. And being there in the beginning and being able to take part in something like that is very exciting. I don't know where the death of photojournalism comment came from. I think the death of photojournalism is in terms of print media closing. That doesn't mean there's a death of photojournalism. I can't count on all our hands, how many photographers are working right now, and giving all their time and all their energy and all their money. We got a couple in the room right here, to the stories that they believe in and issues they believe in. And I think that if we all work really hard, the pictures will be seen by people. People didn't stop caring. It's just some sort of bureaucracy thing. where people care more about celebrities, and I know this, people have said this before, but it's true. Those magazines seem to be up and running no problem. It's just news is where people are struggling right now. But photojournalism is not dead. It's all over the place. We're a huge generation of young photographers that are fighting hard. And the ironic thing is that we never knew the good days. You know, we never knew the business class trip from Paris to, you know, I don't know, Nicaragua, because we never saw that. It's a myth for us. So give us the economy. Give us the last seat. Make us pay for it, and we'll do it. Just buy our pictures and don't sell us out, and we'll keep doing it. So I think that's why everybody's surprised that we're so strong. It's just we've never seen the good days, man.
Well, Life magazine failed not because it didn't have any readers, but because it had too many readers.
Wow.
Life magazine failed because there was an increase in the postal rates.
Really?
Absolutely.
That's the problem. They should have been around for the internet and then take control of that.
Well, precisely.
Which they're not doing right now. They're selling pictures. They're showing all the pictures without copyright of all the photographers and all the work online for everybody to see without anybody having to pay for it. That's a little bit of a problem.
So who's going to cover your expenses?
When? For what?
Now. Aside from the Wall Street Journal.
The clients that I work for. I'm fully booked for November, man.
All right. Was that a question, Wally, or you volunteer?
No. He gave me the bill for the last couple of months. So don't worry. I gotta pay my dues.
At the risk of trivializing this, if you need a drink, raise your hand now, but use your left hand. If you have a question, raise your right hand, and we'll call on you. We've got a couple of questions over here. The young lady here.
Left is
the left. I got it all confused. That's the right. See, it's stage left or stage right. Gentlemen up here.
That's drinks over there. Question in front.
We should have done a different hand signal, something that was clear.
All confusing.
Like a wave. It's like, I really need a fucking drink.
You got a question.
I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm just curious, how do you deal with your own need for survival when you're doing these kind of pictures? Is there ever a concern for your own safety or fear or anything like that?
Sure, that's what keeps us straight. If you weren't scared, I'd be worried about you, buddy. And some aren't, and then you don't travel with them. Some guys get a little too aggressive, and then you don't hang around them too much because they might get into trouble. It's the guys who are scared, or not scared in the point where they can't move. It's just that you're aware of things when you keep your life in your hands because you're paying attention to it as much as you can. I was biking in Toronto on a bicycle, and I stopped paying attention for 2 seconds, got hit by a car. And this happened 3 times. So my likeliness of getting being hurt a lot more likely was in Toronto than it was in these places. Just in terms of paying attention, it's just you have to have a more heightened sense of awareness that's going everything, question everything. Anything that's going around, you just have to question it and analyze it and try and understand it. And follow your gut feelings a lot. Does it, you know, just follow your gut, the instinct, the thing that makes animals move. We have strong minds, but in the end, we're just primitive people, I think. So just follow your gut. That's what I do. Sounds really stupid. I'm sorry, but it's the truth.
Hi. I really applaud your courage and your artistry, and I have two questions.
Yes,
one,
ma'am.
You have a quite distinct visual style. Which, you know, just to give my view, is you know, deeply shadowed with faces and dramatic, you know, elements of the picture in highlight, but in a very naturalistic, in very naturalistic colors. So I'm sort of, I wonder how you achieve that. It's very consistent, very beautiful, very dramatic. And then the second question is...
Can we do one at a time because I have a really bad memory?
Okay. Well, it's just a very simple question.
Yeah.
When you have to get close and empathize with you know these very traumatic scenes, the people who've died violent deaths, children who've had limbs torn off them, how can you preserve your sense of balance?
As in photograph visually.
Well, both visually and as a person.
Okay. First question. I don't know. Some editor told me. I'm sorry that I don't remember who, but said that a visual kind of language is really important. And I think in terms of when I read something in a novel or read anything visually or be it literal, I want a language. I want to feel like I next time I read a book by that person or read a sentence, I know that it's their voice. And I think the same applies for me photographically. I want people to know that it's my picture and that's my voice. So quite early on, really from East Timor all the way to here, I followed a voice that I grew in East Timor. It was really that kind of laid down the groundwork, and then I just kind of tweak it as I go along slightly. It's not too much, not to freak people out. Although I'm talking a lot about shooting an assignment on a mobile phone just to screw with people, but that's another project. But in terms of like visual, and I don't think I'll change my visual language either just because I'm using a different camera. But that was really key for me, and I think to sell your product, also it sounds stupid, but to sell your product and sell your profession, it helps to be consistent. Actually, I think I was entering a competition. That was why I failed. It's because all the pictures looked different, and they didn't feel they knew, they understood who I was and didn't understand where I was going. And it looked like I had a lot of hands and many pies. Is that an expression? I'm the worst expression person, but I think that's somewhat gets it across. Your second question, I forgot now because I was speaking.
Sorry, I don't mean to carry on too long. Okay. It's just how do you preserve your own emotional and your own emotional balance and your professional balance when you have to get up close and personal with these horrendously traumatic scenes and events? So the children, the dead bodies, so forth and so on.
It's the belief in the story. It's the belief that you're there for a reason. I think reason helps anybody do anything. It's the belief that it has to be documented. You'll just deal with whatever happens. It's just you know that this is, if you're there and you've come this far, why would you stop and not be in that situation and photograph it? What happens later, you just have to deal with it. And some people can't. I've been only doing it for a year. Let's talk in 10 years. I might be totally crazy. Or I'll be fine. I think that shouldn't stop us from doing our job. And I have so many people who are supporting me and telling me that I'm doing something good and all that stuff. So I'm going to keep doing it. I'm not going to let them down, let alone let the people down that I'm photographing, just because I got some issues. Talk about their issues. Don't talk about my issues. More questions, please.
I actually have a question.
Right.
Oh, no, just about the technology. I mean, you mentioned kind of passing that you would think about doing an assignment on a mobile phone.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, and you know, Robin referred earlier to the and you commented on the internet being where all the photographs live now, whether they're paid for or not paid for. I mean, it's a very, very different world.
Mm.
And I think that you know, my question is, how does technology affect what you're doing?
I think all of us are getting a lot more done because we can do it quicker and we can also express ourselves more, be much more creative because we can see right away what we're doing wrong or doing right. What the problem is with that is that we're all doing the same thing almost because we're all pushing it in the same direction. Photography is only limited because there's only so much you can do, and I find a lot that I'm looking at the same picture even in my work, which is why I'm trying to change things up in the next couple months. However, I think the internet and this whole, you know, camera phone thing, you know, people say, oh, it's the end of photojournalists because it's citizen photographers. I want to be a citizen photographer. Give me a mobile phone. I'll shoot the hell out of anything. And that's kind of the theory behind it. It's just like I'm almost done with looking at all these pretty pictures taken by Canon 5Ds with 24-1.4 mil lens. It's what we all use, by the way. I want to mix it up a bit. And so I think the internet and the technology is there to play more. I think we should be playing a lot more and experimenting a lot more than we are.
Completely on the other side of the technology question,
yes.
And this sounds like a cheap lead into something that we talked about earlier.
Okay.
Robert Capa said that if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough. But I think we both agree that he wasn't necessarily talking about the distance between you, your lens, and the subject.
Yeah, and I think that took me a while to figure out. It's weird. It seems so simple and so direct that you get it, that it means both things. But I think most people read it literally going like, if you're not, your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough. And it just took me recently.
Well, clearly from your understanding of subject matter and your descriptions, you know, of what's behind the photograph and all the events surrounding the photograph, being close is more intellectual than it is physical.
Yeah, sure, but it transforms into you reacting differently into in different situations. I love this job because we get to be close to people, and they let you in, and then you share something together. I had problems working as a newspaper photographer because it's so quickly. You work on, you know, 5 minutes to an hour. That's the longest you get, and you do 7 of those a day. How are you going to connect with anybody in 5 minutes? I mean, yes, I can do it. Yeah, and we can all do it. We can make a good picture. But I want to spend hours, days with these people. And ironically, and I'm getting now longer assignments with longer days, and it's still not enough. I know that I need to be working on, you know, month-long projects. And the Congo is a, you know, almost two-month-long project. And I can feel it because I spent time there. And I struggled, and I was sick there, and I was, you know, having a good time, having a bad time, connecting with people, being let into people's lives. You need to go through up and down, the whole life thing in these stories, in these projects. A day won't make a difference. 5 days is just a teaser. I'm doing these 5 days assignments, and it's the worst teaser. It's like you're just on the surface level, and you want to get in there way deeper, but you can't because you have to leave now. So I think the future for myself, and I think a lot of young guys, is to stick it out and do long-term projects and tell you guys really what's going on in that part of the world.
Isn't that expecting an awful lot, though, that somebody's going to have the wherewithal to be able to stick around for a couple of months without earning any do-re-mi?
Well, it'll come back. I think if you do the work and it's personal and you really care about it, it'll come back. It came back for me. I really did. All the Gaza, I funded myself. East Timor, I funded myself. Detroit, I funded myself. And there I am in Congo, funding myself to get probably enough fully funding myself. I think I took like $800 with me, and within 4 days it was gone because I had to pay off so many people. And then I got my parents Western Union some money, which is still getting. I'm working on getting the money back. I'm just starting up. Wait, are you gonna? Anyway, but Congo was the first place where people paid attention. They liked the work I'd done before. And after four trips, four projects, Detroit I worked for almost altogether, like 3-4 months back and forth. And I think it came back. I mean, I think if you put the work in, you know, people care. It's as simple as that.
We've got about 3 or 4 more minutes. The promise is to be done by 9:30, and it's 9:25. If there are any questions, please raise your hand. Lady in front.
I don't need a microphone.
Yeah.
Talk as loud as you like.
No, okay.
Oh,
just,
no, there's one.
I would like... Frau Megelein, I'd like to introduce Frau Megelein. She was our a receptionist and the woman of German Swiss International School. You could not, you could not get by her. Every day you bump into her. Good or bad.
I just wanted to say, Dominic, you're doing a fantastic job. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
You bring us photos like that,
yeah,
showing us what other human being can do to each other.
Mm.
I don't think you should give up at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess I should have pointed out it doesn't have to be a question.
Yes,
perfectly fine. Lady in the back here. Yeah?
Please don't.
What's wrong hand? What, is it a drink or is it a question?
The wave, man. I need a drink.
It's a question. Do you have any
it's not a question. It's a drink.
Do you have any personal barriers in terms of what you won't intrude on? Grief, etc.
Wow. Yeah. Every situation is different completely. One of the things I talked about before, and I might be repeating myself, not here, somewhere else, was when we uncovered the massacres that were that happened the day before, not even the night of, and we were there in the morning. We were four photographers, and we're all like kind of crouching over these bodies. I felt horrible. I had never felt so bad in my life. And I just, yeah, I felt like a scavenger, felt like I was doing this for money. And I wasn't. I mean, I really wasn't. But those were the bad things. And then I told myself, just keep shooting, you know, just don't think about it too much. And ironically, I was the only guy who got printed. From those four guys, I was the only guy who got printed. Nobody else got their pictures from that day. So if I wouldn't have taken pictures, maybe I wouldn't have, nobody would have seen those pictures. So you never know how the ripple effect happens. Obviously, if people don't ask me not to photograph, I won't. I won't press, unless it's really something that I think is important. They might not understand that it's important. I do, so I'll break that barrier. All kinds of issues. Like every situation is different. And sometimes you're dealing with your own kind of barriers, and sometimes you're dealing with barriers from other people. And then you make those decisions as you go. Yeah.
Any other questions? Let's leave it with this as a last question, and that is, you've talked about, you know, going on assignment for the Wall Street Journal and that relationship. But what's next? What happens next?
Finally, yeah, like I said, finally I have a home in Kenya, and it's really comfy. I got a motorbike. First, I traveled with 30 kilograms the entire year. That's including a bulletproof vest, so it's pretty light traveling. And finally, I bought something for myself, and it was a Chinese-made motorbike that drives really slowly. And as you're driving, all the bits fall off. And you kind of have to get off, and then you stop the bike, and you pick
it up. Mom, don't listen.
No. That's fine. It's actually not that bad. And then you stop your bike, and then you have to pick it up. And then it doesn't start anymore, so you have to have somebody push the bike so you get started. And then you'd love to say thank you, but you're rolling, and you don't want to stop again. So I got that going for me. Yeah, Nairobi's great. Just a few more things. Nairobi's awesome because it just really feels like you're out there. They're super technology savvy. You can get internet on your phone anywhere, but we don't have water every third day. And every second day, we don't have electricity. So it's like a mix of two worlds. You can have Italian food and watch satellite TV for one day and then not do that the next day. But now that I have a home, I'm looking to work in East Africa and in the Middle East, specifically in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. That war has been going on too long, and I really always wanted to be part of documenting it. I just haven't been settled enough. Now I am. And it's a great... Most of the guys that work in Nairobi actually do that. They work... Not most, but a lot of them do work in Afghanistan and work in East Africa. And when East Africa is a little quiet, they go over there. And right, I'm going back to do an assignment on tea, so I'd rather actually go to Afghanistan right now.
I got one real quick one.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Can you bring the same sensitivities to the other side of the world?
Which other side?
During the Farm Security Administration.
Nice.
Walker Evans and others photographed and Dorothea Lange photographed the Dust Bowl and Okies going to California, starving people. But Marjorie Post Walcott went to Miami and photographed the rich folks.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see what you might bring to that equation.
Well, actually, I'm not interested so much in the rich folk. I'm more interested in sort of superstructures and things like that, so maybe I'll do a project on tankers. I really like metal and big things, so
tankers,
yeah. No, I just think like craft and sort of human achievement and things like that. So I know this sounds so stupid, and I wish we could end on another question. Could we end on another question, please? I just said superstructure, and I like metal. So please, and one more question. Anybody?
Put your microphone.
Bob Davis just woke up. Ladies and gentlemen, a big hand for Bob Davis.
He's asleep again.
To Wally and Anita.
Again, we struggled to find the question, but I don't think he was asking for another drink. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for coming tonight. Apologies for the technical difficulties. The photographs from the Congo are downstairs, and they're here for most of the rest of the month. They're on the wall downstairs, so we thank Dominic very, very much for actually going through a lot to get the pictures here. If anybody here is from FedEx, we can talk to you afterwards, but that's another story altogether. The photographs are printed in a rush job, matted, mounted, and hung. Stellar work on behalf of John Batten and the FCC staff. but mostly on behalf of Dominic for taking the damn things in the first place. So thank you all very much for being here, and enjoy the rest of the show, which runs for a week. Thank you very much.
What's the wave again?
Yeah, you can wave again. Get a drink over here. And isn't it funny that a photographer has like the weirdest random screensaver and all of that?
Yeah, cool. When you make noises, it gets bigger. I'm making comments I shouldn't be making him right now.
How do you switch this thing off? Turn that off.
Oh, the bell. Dude.
Oh, sorry, God. Thank you.